Welcome to Language Chats. This is a podcast for language lovers in Australia and beyond, where we share our experiences of language learning with you, as well as the stories of other Australians and a few international guests who love learning, working with, and communicating using other languages. I'm Penny.
And I'm Beck, and we'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we're recording today, the Wadawurrung people, the Dja Wurrung people, and the Wurundjeri people, and we pay our respects to their elders past and present. Today we have a special guest with us, and we're very excited to speak to Howie Manns, Senior Lecturer in Linguistics and Applied Linguistics at Monash University here in Victoria. Howie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Very excited to have you here on Language Chats. Now, before we get a bit more into it, could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in language?
Sure. Now, as you said, I'm a lecturer in linguistics, a senior lecturer in linguistics, but I wouldn't have imagined that I would have ended up here. I actually was born and raised in a really monolingual environment. I was raised at the northernmost edges of Appalachia in the US and mostly monolingual. We spoke a mix of local English, Pittsburgh English, it's called, or Pittsburghese, but also mixed in with a bit of African-American English. And the way that I came to language for the first time was, when I was probably about 10 years old, the factories in town closed. And whenever the factories in town closed, everybody got really poor, and my parents worked really hard to kind of make us not feel poor. And one of the ways that they did that was they took us to the library and dropped us off. And I gravitated toward two kinds of books. One of them was Ghost. I loved spiritual stuff. And the other was language books. I just went to the language section and I thought, gosh, it's just like Ghost. It's otherworldly. And I explored those sorts of books. And, you know, language for me has always been something that's been lurking ever since. You know, it's never something that I imagined I would go into a career for, but it was always there. But, anytime I tried to escape from it, I ended up coming back to it. As an example of this, when I was 18, I went to join the Navy, the U.S. Navy, because I thought, well, I wanted to get out of this town. I wanted to get out and see the world. And I wanted to do something really innocuous. So I joined the Navy to be a chef, of all things. But when I took the test to be a chef, they said, well, actually, you have this strange competency in language. So we think that maybe you should be a linguist. And yeah, and that's what I ended up doing. I went to the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California, and I studied Farsi, the language of Iran. And I ended up working in that, and language just kept me, it just kept taking me to new places. So I kept following those places.
Oh, that's amazing. Before you had this kind of light bulb moment when you were told you had this aptitude for language learning, had you done formal language study, or was it something that the Navy just said, yep, you've got something special, let's try and capture this?
So I'm still not convinced that I have anything special. I feel like maybe there was some kind of admin mistake along the way, but I'm going to ride this out for the rest of my life. I had studied language in high school the same as anybody else did. So I took French. I was a decent student, but I didn't really think that I had any particular aptitude in language. And in fact, even when I went to the Defense Language Institute, I really thought I was going to fail out. Like, I just thought, this is going to be great. I'm going to go to California, live in California for a while, and I'm going to study the Farsi, which at the time, I didn't even know it was spelled F-A-R-S-I. I thought it was F-A-R-S-S-E-A, and that I would be going to the Pacific or something. Like, I was just that green and simple. It was, whenever I got into the school, though, I did pretty well, and I did better than I would have ever expected. And I think that's when, I'm not 100% sure that I have any kind of special competency in language, but I enjoy it enough to keep me going. And I think that's what I learned in the Defense Language Institute.
Yeah, that's a big jump actually, going from not having studied, well, maybe doing some high school French to jumping into something like Farsi. Also because a different script, and like how did you find, how was that process of then kind of taking a formal and also from what I have heard, kind of military linguistic training is very different to the kinds of, you know, learning a language for pleasure type courses that people may be used to taking as an adult perhaps, or even at university. Like what came across you sort of as a young person, 18, 19 year old, encountering that challenge?
I was invigorated by, look, at first I was horrified by it, like absolutely horrified, because, you know, Arabic script, how am I ever going to learn this new way of writing thing? I feel like I barely had learned how to write English, and suddenly I had to learn Arabic script. But after you get a sense of it, you realize that, you know, it's just another way of representing the world, which is gorgeous. And then you just lean into it and you discover all of these different aspects of this new language, as, you know, as you both know, that just keep you going. Simple things at first, you know, like, oh, wow. So the verb goes at the end of all of the sentences, no matter what happens. And that's really exciting. But then suddenly you begin to learn these little phrases that just help you step to the left or right of what it means to be human. You know, I just kept coming across these gorgeous phrases in Farsi in particular, like, you know, whenever an Iranian meets another Iranian, sometimes they say khaste naboshin, which just means don't be tired. And I'm like, wow, that just feels like such a nice thing to say to people, because, you know, things are just so exhausting. Wouldn't it be nice if we all just walked around and went, hang in there, don't be tired.
I like that.
That's a lovely thing to say.
So after your intensive Farsi training, what was the next step for you? Did you, you know, were you part of the Navy for a little while, or how did it all work for you?
So I actually ended up getting assigned to an aircraft carrier reconnaissance squadron. So there was this four-seat plane called the ES-3 in the 90s, and it was like a airplane that flew around the Persian Gulf like a vacuum cleaner for signals and voices. And in fact, you know, when my kid was going to you know, prep, he drew this picture of an airplane that was a vacuum cleaner for voices. And the teacher said, God, your kid has such a wild imagination. And I was like, no, that's kind of what I used to do. So that's what I did. I flew from five different aircraft carriers, mostly in the Persian Gulf. And yeah, and every now and then I would get to do interpreting. So I would go onto smaller ships too and get to meet people, get to talk to different people. And, you know, that changed the way I viewed the world, really. Because I think there's a bit of a switch that happens there when you get to talk to people in the other language, because, you know, like when you're doing passive things, you know, it's all out there, but suddenly when you're face to face with people and getting to connect with people, God, people are really likable, even if you've been trained to maybe think that they're not so likable, you know? And ever since then, to me, language has kind of filled that role of actually just being able to connect with other people in a way that I don't think that, that you can without being able to speak that language, or at least not as deeply as you can.
Absolutely. Now, how did you then, so firstly, did you get to do any other language study while you were in the military? And then when did you decide to leave?
I had no intention of staying at all, whether I was a chef, whether I was a chef or a linguist or whatever they wanted me to do. It was definitely a short term gig. I learned some Arabic along the way, because I lived in Bahrain at the time. I spent a lot of time in Bahrain, so I learned some Arabic along the time. But yeah, for the most part, yeah, I left the military. And once again, I thought I was done with language. It seemed like a great thing to do. I was going to go be a journalist. So I went and I majored in journalism. But by the end of my journalism major, I was a linguistics major. It just kept following me, really.
I like that, how just linguistics keeps creeping up. It's following you around.
I had no intention. I mean, you know, I had no intention of being a linguist or being an academic or any of those sorts of things. Like, it just, language was always this constant that I kept going back to. And then one day it just, I don't know, swallowed me up. And I guess I'm happy enough with that.
And by the time you were a linguistics major, had you then already decided that you would stay in academia?
No, God, no. Even now, I'm kind of, I sometimes get a bit weirded out that I am in academia. My plan when I finished my linguistics degree was to either go into journalism or to go into to be a diplomat. I wanted to be an American diplomat at the time. So I conjured up this plan, once again with language, where I studied French and Vietnamese in university, because I thought, well, wouldn't it be cool to be trilingual? So I had this big plan to go live in Hanoi. I thought, I'm going to go live and kind of speak English and French and Vietnamese. Finished uni, went to Hanoi, couldn't find a job, hopped a train to China. And even though I hadn't studied Chinese, I ended up in this Chinese town called Chufu in Shandong province. So it was amazing, like absolutely the most amazing, one of the most amazing experiences in my life, because I showed up in this town. There weren't many people who spoke English. I spoke virtually no Mandarin. So it was essentially from like the ground up, just talking to people and people taking me under their wing. And yeah, it was gorgeous.
That's amazing.
And what did you do while you were there? Yeah, how did you did you find a job?
I was an English teacher. Like, okay. So that's what I was looking. That's what I was looking for a job in Hanoi to do too. Was I wanted to, I thought it'd be a good way to get to live in a place, to get to understand a place well enough. Because, you know, in my head, I thought, well, I'm going to be a diplomat. I should go to these places and better understand people. I love language, so I'm going to make that the thing that I do. So, and that's ultimately what took me to Indonesia, because the China job, for various reasons, they couldn't sponsor my visa, so I had to get out of there in a hurry. And I thought, God, where am I going to go? And I saw this big, big piece of the Pacific Ocean that had like tens of thousands of islands, and it was predominantly Muslim. And I thought, how have I never heard of this place? I'll tell you what, I'm just going to go to it and I'm going to find a job. And I did. I looked online. I found a job. It seemed legit. So I flew to Indonesia and lived in a traditional neighborhood and taught English there for what ended up being about 2 years.
And was the beginning of your kind of love of all things Indonesian, and what has led you to now your current kind of academic career, if I'm right. What happened next, and where does Australia fit in? And yes, tell us.
Yeah. So Australia actually has a lot of the, outside of Indonesia, Australia has some of the biggest scholars of Indonesia. So I thought it would be, I had turned off to the idea of being a diplomat. Me and America were beginning to ideologically separate a little bit, without going down that path. So I thought, well, there's a really interesting thing happening in Indonesia, because it was just after the fall of Suharto. Suharto had essentially run a 32-year dictatorship, and it was really wrapped up in language. Suharto was really imposing this national language on people, and a particular form of this national language. But just after the fall of Suharto, suddenly people could use whatever language they wanted. And because people could use whatever language they wanted in the media, in the streets, there was a really interesting question to ask about, well, what are they choosing to use now that the dictatorship is over? You know, like, what are they actually speaking? So I contacted some people in Australia, some potential supervisors, and I thought, I'd like to study this. How does this sound? And they said, it sounds fantastic. And I didn't really still anticipate that this would lead to any kind of academic career. I think I was just looking for some kind of professional cover to do something that I enjoyed doing for a couple of more years, because I don't know, academic jobs are pretty hard to come by. So I just thought, I'll go to Australia, I'll live in a different English speaking country for a couple of years, I'll use it as cover to, I don't know, keep my mother off my back about why aren't you getting a real job. And that was it. Yeah. That's how I'm Yay. Here in the end.
This is already sounding like a very rich story so far, which I'm loving, Howie. And especially given that this is how it's gotten you to Australia, like that's a lot of different places and a lot of different languages to make your way back to another English-speaking country. Or, you know, predominantly seen as being an English-speaking country. Yeah. So that is wonderful. So tell us next, what happened next with your study and your plan of trying to find a cover for something that you just wanted to do for another couple of years. How obviously that must have been successful for you.
Yeah, more than I ever expected. I mean, about two years into doing my PhD, one of my supervisors who were second language acquisition and Indonesian studies people, Julie Bradshaw and Simon Musgrave, they talked to me and they said, why are you doing this? And the honest to God answer was, I don't know. You know, I think they kind of expected that there would be some kind of pathway, and I didn't really know. And they said, well, we think that maybe you would be okay at being an academic if you wanted to do that kind of work. So I started teaching, I started writing a little bit, and that's how I ended up eventually getting hired by Monash. I became part of the furniture, I guess. And they gave me a job, and whenever that happened, it kind of changed the way that I viewed what I was doing to some degree too, because I thought, you know, being hired as an academic or getting a job doing something that you love, like language, even though it's kind of lurking there, chasing you down and finally overtaking you, I thought, well, I've got to do something with this now, which is kind of the way that I think about a lot of what I do for research. Is it's kind of like, well, this is a really privileged position, and I want to be able to spend my privilege by studying the kinds of things that hopefully can make society a little bit better. Because for me, and I would presume that you agree because you're doing this podcast, we don't talk about language nearly enough. And people sometimes assume that because we're surrounded by language, that we know about language, and we don't. So what I've been trying to do since I've settled into this job, which I guess was, God, 10 years ago now, is to research the kinds of topics where hopefully we can learn a little bit more about the way that people communicate and hopefully apply that to, just make people's lives better. And that's what I spend a lot of time doing now. Trying to increase numbers of young Australians taking up Indonesian, which is one of my projects now, I study deaf-blind communication because Australia has a significant number of people who are born deaf and lose their eyesight over the course of their lives. So we're trying to better understand how they communicate with each other, so also we can train interpreters and communication guides to help them out. And also, I'm back in English again. I study the history and the evolution of English and what this means for classrooms, because, you know, the approach to teaching English in classrooms has not been great, really, not been best practice. So I'm trying to inform that stuff.
I love that you've got so much going on in your world, your research world. Like, it's, you know, quite a few different but related kind of areas of research and work. If we can we go back to the Indonesian stuff for a second? The research that you did, you know, way back when you were starting out as a baby academic, what was the findings, and what did you discover in terms of language use and that kind of thing back in that era when things were changing?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I mean, essentially what I was interested in is, well, you know, you've got all of these different Indonesian varieties that people can choose from, because they had a lot of varieties. They've got this standard variety that the government was pushing for about 32 years that had almost just become I don't know, like a Frankenstein's monster of sorts that people just didn't really, really use. But then they had all of these other historical varieties, Indonesian ways of speaking Indonesian that were around. And what I was finding was that, you know, people are just drawn to the kinds of language that is most useful for them in whatever uses they need it for, you know. And what I'm getting at with this is sometimes we want people to use the standard language. Sometimes we want people to use like a fancy way of speaking, and it's not the right way to actually speak. And it creates almost this dissonance in any kind of place, any society, between what people aspirationally want to happen and what people are actually doing. And it can create a lot of problems in anyone's society. So it was creating a problem in Indonesia in the same way that like English creates a problem here, you know, standard English debates. As an example, you know, standard English is a really blunt instrument. We tell people, oh, you know, speak standard English. You've got to speak standard English, without actually helping people to value the way that they speak. And whenever that happens, it means that people don't learn standard English as quickly. The best thing that we can possibly do is help people value the way that they speak for the purposes that they use those languages for. And if we do that, we can actually help guide people toward learning these other varieties. And the same thing was happening in Indonesia. Was it was an incoherent language space, because what people wanted to happen wasn't happening, and they were trying to micromanage it. And what essentially I was finding was, just let it go, let it go. Just, you know, let people use the language that they want to. And, you know, it's actually surprisingly, you know, cohesive. It's good practice. Indonesia is great for this in particular, because, you know, one of my favorite things about Indonesia is you go out over the course of a day, and, you know, you can meet a woman at a market. Thinking of a specific person, I used to go eat breakfast in the local market and speak Javanese to a woman who ran my favorite mixed rice stand. Then I would go chat to a Chinese woman in Chinese Indonesian. Then I would go speak to this other man who ran a different shop, and he was a Tetum speaker, and he insisted that I spoke Spanish to him because he said he could understand it. And that's the way that language works in Indonesia. Sorry, that's a very long-winded answer.
No, I think it's really fascinating. Thank you.
It is fascinating too, because often, and we have spoken to a couple of different people about this on the podcast previously, but the emotional connection that we have with language as humans is, I think, a fascinating thing, and such an interesting part of the way that we interact with each other. Because, like you were saying about kind of the standard Indonesian, which I'm guessing by that you mean like sort of Bahasa, it is like when you have a different, you have a language that you're comfortable in expressing yourself and expressing your emotions, and you want to talk to your friends and your family in, maybe there might be more than one language, of course, too, in that mix. Mm-hmm. But the, you know, the formalized, standardized languages that we sometimes have to use for other parts of our lives, maybe it's for administration, maybe it's for work, maybe, you know, it could be anything, but they have totally different functions in the world and in how we respond, whether it is emotionally or quite logically, you know. Yeah. And I think that sort of interaction is just super, super interesting, but very, very much at play in what you're talking about with Indonesia.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, it's also relevant to my personal life too, because when I went to work in the Navy as a Farsi interpreter, I was generally good when I was speaking to people in Farsi. I could speak to people and make sense, even if sometimes they spoke a related dialect of Persian, like Hazaragi or Dari. You could make sense of what they were saying. But the weird thing to me when I would translate into English sometimes is the people wouldn't understand me. The Americans wouldn't understand what I was saying because I was speaking a non-standard variety of English, my Pittsburgh English, is kind of strong. So I had to change the way that I spoke, and I kind of shifted into a more standard way of speaking. Now, that takes me to a point that I think illustrates what you're saying, which is when I went back to Pittsburgh to go to university, my friends told me that I spoke like the dictionary. You know, and they made fun of me for speaking like that, because that's not the kind of language that's good to use with your friends in those circumstances. And that's just it. I mean, language has this emotional connection with people, and that's one of the reasons why I think the standard variety of Indonesian, Bahasa or Bahasa Baku, as they call it, it's essentially because they tried to manage it so much, they sucked the soul out of it. And because they sucked the soul out of it, people didn't really use it outside of the radio.
What's the current state of Indonesian learning and Indonesian teaching in Australia at the moment? How do you feel we're tracking in terms of our Indonesian language acquisition?
Terribly. It's been on the decline for a couple of decades now, actually. I mean, really, really significant decline. If you go back into the 90s, whenever Paul Keating was supporting Indonesian, there were 22 universities that were teaching Indonesian, and now it's down to 11 or 12. It's just a significant decline. I've got a colleague at who runs the exchange program at Chichis, and he's Liam Prince, and Liam's put forth a really good argument that, you know, government funding is tied to this, and you can look at the graphs, and whenever the government has been funding Indonesian, the numbers are up, and whenever the government isn't funding Indonesian, the numbers go down. And I 100% support that, but also I think we've got to think a little more creatively. I've been arguing that we've got to think a little more creatively, because even if the funding comes back, you know, sometimes it's related to whatever political party is in power at any one time. So, yeah, I think we've got to work a little bit harder to understand the reasons why young people do or don't study Indonesian, because we haven't researched that nearly as much as we should. But also, I think we need to work together to create really responsive materials for the students too, with that in mind. There's a lot to be done in this space for sure. And, you know, I appreciate all of the grassroots efforts that are underway to do things, but the government and industry have to step up too, or it's just going to keep declining, I think.
In addition to, government funding perhaps being a very big influence on whether or not students take a language like Indonesian, or really other languages too, in Australia at school level, what would you say you think is the biggest challenge into motivating school-age students to learn another language?
Yeah, wow. That's the million-dollar question for all of us. There's a couple of things. I mean, a lot of it is just the ideologies that they're surrounded with. I mean, if you look at Australian students, they have some of the lowest take up of second languages in the developed world compared to a lot of other nations. A lot of that is just quite simply some of the discourse that they're surrounded by, some of the attitudes that they're surrounded by. You know, of course, Michael Klein has long talked about this monolingual mindset in Australia, and he's not wrong. I think there is this mindset, and you get this from politicians too. You know, John Howard at various points had pointed out that, well, why are we going to study these Asian languages, because they speak English? But the thing is we're not even preparing our students to be able to speak in English to people from Asia, because notoriously native speakers from places like Australia or Britain are a problem in lingua franca conversations. And what that means is if you get a Chinese person speaking English with an Indonesian person, they do really well. You throw in an Australian or a British person or an American person, and the conversation falls apart. So we're not preparing our students in that way. The other argument that you come across in this sphere is that, well, why are we teaching these languages, or why do we have to teach these languages? Because, you know, we've got these diasporic communities, but once again, nobody's investing in these diasporic communities, at least nobody with any kind of power. You've got lots of gorgeous grassroots efforts, like, you know, in the western suburbs of Melbourne, you've got, you know, Viet Speak, which was this movement to revitalize the teaching of Vietnamese. And those sorts of movements, I think, are great because they show young people that we care. They show young people that we're going to get behind language. But, you know, until we change the way that people think about language, I think that we could get stuck floundering in this space. But there's hope out there too, I think. You know, there's hope in the sense that there's lots of, as I said, grassroots efforts like Viet Speak, but also people like you doing podcasts like this, talking about language.
Oh, nobody has to force us to do this. We just do it because we like it.
One of the other areas that you're working in, which is also super interesting, is the deaf-blind communication and all this, you know, the studies about how people who are deaf and blind are communicating with each other. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because that sounds, you know, really impactful and meaningful and something with a great kind of purpose as well.
It's absolutely amazing. And what I take away from that community is it's amazing to watch two human beings to get together and work so hard to communicate with each other, because I think that that's something that sometimes we English speakers don't even do. But when you get a couple of deaf-blind people together, what you're getting together are a couple of people oftentimes who learned Australian Sign Language at different points in history. And because they've learned at different points in history, they don't always share the same signs. Never mind the fact that, you know, the signing space, of course, is kind of broad typically, but with deaf-blind communication, the signing space gets much smaller. And it's interesting in a number of ways, in the sense of what happens when the signing space gets more constricted. How do they cope with that restricted signing space? But also, how do you convey things like prosody, like emotion, for instance? Because people haven't really actually paid that much attention to this. And a great example of this is, you know, whenever we look at deaf-blind people communicating, sometimes you're like, okay, well, how did they get that sign? How did they get that sign? Because it doesn't look like they actually had hand contact. But actually, if you watch them enough, you see that they do things like they have their legs interconnected. Mm. Like they can feel if somebody pulls back whenever they're signing, or they can feel if somebody's leaning forward. And that tells us something about conversational engagement. And another thing that comes up is, again, when the signing space changes, sometimes we begin to sign in different parts of our body, and the deaf-blind person can't always understand that. And there's this story, I'll tell the story. It's Heather Lawson, who is an amazing deaf-blind woman. She tells this story of how she was at a meeting, and the meeting was getting a little bit tricky at some point, and somebody said, "Think," but she thought they said "go to the pub," because, you know, and she was like, "Yeah, I'm over this meeting too. Let's go to the pub." and she was very embarrassed. But these are the sorts of things that we come across with, you know, with working with deaf-blind Australians. It's just an amazing communicative community. And to watch them get together and just revel in communication is wonderful in the first instance, but also to watch some of these really nuanced ways that I think people haven't paid enough attention to in the way the communication happens. And yeah, it's probably, yeah, one of the more impactful things I've been lucky enough to be involved with. But to be clear, that project is predominantly on the back of my colleague, Louisa Willoughby, who's been really engineering and kind of innovating in that space for many years. And also, yeah, it's worth highlighting Heather Lawson, who is one of the core members of the deaf-blind community here in Melbourne, and she's just been absolutely amazing with helping us with the research, but also just working with other deafblind people on how to communicate.
Yeah, really cool.
There have been a lot of references, Howie, that I just wanted to reassure anyone who's listening, we will do our very best to put together comprehensive show notes so that if you want to look up any of these things or find out more information, perhaps from some of your academic work, then we will do our best to reference that so that you can find it at ease. And just to move on to something else that we know that you study, Howie, one of the other things that is part of your portfolio, I suppose, is Australian English, I think, which sounds like a really fun part of academia, I would like to say, because obviously the way Australians speak is super interesting, am I right?
You are not wrong at all. It's amazing. I am head over heels in
there
love
you
with
go.
Your English.
There you go. You got it.
Oh, stop it.
I love that it's an American as well who's really into the Aussie English. It's great.
But it's what's amazing from an academic perspective about Australian English is it's a comparatively young English. You only outside of Britain, you only have a limited number of Englishes that have gone through all of the developmental cycles where they've become full on national Englishes, and you know, like American English, New Zealand English, and Australian English. But Australian English only kind of fully came into its own in the 1980s, and that's really interesting because until the 1980s, you know, we didn't see much. We saw a little bit of social variation, but you don't see regional variation at all in Australian English. But more and more, you're seeing some regional variation emerge. People in, you know, in Victoria speaking slightly different than people in New South Wales, for instance, and South Australia. So, you know, that's what's exciting about it. But what's really, I think, overall exciting about Australian English outside of that is, if you go back into history, there's almost like this urgency about coming up with the right words to be able to talk about this new place. And there's this urgency, you know, you go and read, like E.E. Morris wrote one of the first dictionaries of Australian English. And he had this profound statement of like, never in history has there been such a land that has presented English speakers and blah, blah, blah. And I don't know if I fall totally into that, but it does have this urgency. And also, you know, the words that get selected for Australian English are, you know, there's a lot of folk tales around them. There's a lot of stories around them, and they're not even the real stories sometimes. The fake stories about Australian words are actually sometimes even the better stories. Chunder is a great example of this. So Chunder, you know, a lot of people think that this comes from, you know, on the ship trips over, you know, on the ship journeys over, that if you were going to vomit off the top of a boat, you would yell, "Watch under!" And that's where it came from. But it's,
I have never heard that story before.
Have you not? But but it's really, all it is it's just a British dialect word. And there was this huge influx of British dialect words after the Goldfields era in the late 19th century. And all these British dialect words just flooded in, like dinkum, chunder, you know, bonzer, any number of these words. And they've all developed their own stories, but most of those stories are completely not true at all. The true story, like I said, of chunder is that it's a British dialect word. This whole watch under thing actually came from Barry Humphreys. And in fact, the word was die. Yeah, the word was going to die until Barry brought it back.
Oh my God, that in itself, you're right. The story is better than the word, I think. I mean, I hear the word chunder and I'm like, ooh. I don't think I like that. But I love the story and that is great. And I'm definitely going to tell some other people about that now that I know it. You know, I think that's really interesting. And I didn't realize actually that Australian English had like when you talk about it coming into its own from kind of the 1980s, like, I mean, I think back now about some of the historical, you know, footage that you would see even sometimes in audio that you hear from perhaps the ABC, and really before about the 80s or even maybe the 70s, like it's still, things still sound very English, actually. From a broadcast perspective, you know, the voices that you hear still have a real received pronunciation, BBC style sound to them. And then, you know, probably more, I'm guessing, like, and tell me if I'm wrong, but like as media grew and media became more accessible as well, and, you know, television and film and radio, and now, of course, the internet, has that had a much more significant impact on driving the growth and change and diversity of Australian English?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that really helped Australian English come into its own was that by the 1960s, you had a couple of champions for Australian English. A.G. Mitchell and Arthur Delbridge were two champions of Australian English because, as you've rightfully pointed out, until the 1960s, you weren't even allowed to have an Australian accent on the radio, or at least it wasn't something that was looked positively upon. You generally would have these received pronunciation accents, or as people would sometimes talk about them, the you know, the cultivated Australian accents. And over time, these people who promoted the Australian accent helped us kind of feel more comfortable about the Australian accent. That certainly helped. And then gradually we just got more comfortable with it. And then there was also this era of, like, you know, the era of awkwardom, which Barry Humphreys contributed to go back to our, sorry, I chose that example, Chunder, it's so awful.
so fine. Truly, it was an excellent story.
but that actually, that helped propel Australian English into its own. And as you rightfully point out, I mean, the internet is and kind of digital communication is certainly helping with that sort of thing too. As an example, you know, do you know the word gronk by chance?
I do not. Oh. As somebody who has lived in Australia pretty much my whole life, I do not know that word.
So for gronk, One of the projects that we have, of course, is on Australian slang. We did a big survey of, you know, what are the most popular ways that you tell somebody that they're silly or stupid. And overwhelmingly, it was a dated word. Drongo was the number one word. But gronk is another way of saying it. And gronk is a relatively recent way of saying it that probably, as I understand it, came from Sydney, New South Wales, but it's spread on Twitter of all places, which of course is a place where I guess you call people gronk more than usual. Because of that, people are using this word in other places. Also, yeah, God, I mean, the Australian superstar in the global economy, Selfie, of course, you know, Selfie is
yes.
You know, that came from the internet. That came from an ABC chat board. So, you know, that speaks to what you're saying.
Is that really where it came from, an ABC chat board?
That was the first. We can't be sure that that's where it was invented, but that is the first place that we've ever seen it, is on an ABC chat board. I wish I could remember the guy's name because he deserves credit for using it there. But suddenly it spread around the world. It was the Dutch Dictionary Word of the Year, Oxford Dictionary Word of the Year. You know, we're having our impact in the global lexicon now. I'm here for it.
Yeah, I did know that it was like an Australian word, but good to know that I wasn't somehow making that up, although I'm sure I'd read it somewhere on the internet. I do love how Australians, in the way that we talk, the way that we shorten words, and I think that has become something that is, you know, that is really recognisably Australian. You know, shortening names, shortening really any kind of word, especially to try and make light of a situation. I think if something is a bit too heavy or too serious, then we have this way of kind of trying to diminish a word in order to diminish the stress, I think, of whatever that particular thing is that you might be talking about. And something else that is noted, I have just thought actually about something that's really appeared very, very consistently actually in social media more recently, is this idea of the Australian O sound, which years and years and years ago, now, or at least it feels that long ago. No, it was a little bit over 10 years ago. When I was studying overseas in Canada, a little bit over 10 years ago. Okay, it was like 14 years ago. While I was there, this is a roundabout way to getting to where I'm going, but stick with me. I joined a novice rowing team at the university that I was studying at, and I was the coxswain. So I got to just yell at everybody all the time, which was lots of fun. I had a little microphone on, and I'd say go a lot. And the girls that I rode with all used to make fun of the way that I said go, and it was very recognisably Australian on the water. But now, certainly a lot on social media, and I think maybe with TikTok and Reels, and there's been this whole thing about how we say no and that it sounds like an R sound, which I don't think it sounds like an R at all as an Australian speaker or Australian English speaker. But, you know, the way that people are sort of spelling it, this N-A-U-R, again, don't really know if it really sounds like that to an Australian. But, you know, what do you think drives that interest in this difference in the way that we speak and our accent?
I think they were fascinated by these different ways that we use language, of course. And the Australian accent in particular is really interesting, because, you know, it is so full of these diphthongs and triphthongs. So, like, you know, two vowels in the same space, or three vowels, you know, like in, I'm not going to do the no in an Australian accent.
It's okay. I'll do it for you. Oh, no. or as everyone on the internet keeps saying, oh, no.
But people get interested in it, but also people get really, I don't know, people love to fight about this stuff. You think about, you know, as an example, the potato cake debate. People or potato cakes and potato scallops and these sorts of things. People get really, really, I don't know, angry, kind of, but not really about
territorial?
It. Yeah.
Maybe territorial, I'm not sure. Very defensive.
Exactly. And I think we get a bit of joy about that stuff. The other really interesting thing I think with Australian English and Australian words in particular is, you know, we love to really look at me use we here. I've been here for a while, so I'm gonna claim this. Like we love to confuse people about these words. We love to use them to be able to confuse outsiders. But then, you know, part of the game is actually to teach people these words. You know, we also really, really love teaching people these words. And I've got this full life trajectory where when I first got to Australia, I was walking up and down on Sydney Road in Brunswick looking for a cafe called Arvo, you know, because my friend said, let's meet in the Arvo. And I was like, okay, I can't find that cafe. But now, you know, I feel like I'm at that level where maybe I can, I don't know, do a linguistic drop bear or something, you know, where
a linguistic
drop bear is something that a friend of mine named Lee Murray came up with, and it's where you tell somebody that a word is an Australian English word but you've completely made it up, you know, like just whatever. Oh. Like just throw an O or an E on the end of something, and
And you just see if people like run with it.
Yeah, you see if people
like. Do they try and use it in conversation and hope that it takes?
You try. I've not had luck yet, but I mean, you have a podcast. Maybe you can get somebody to do this for you.
Oh, maybe we can sneak in a little linguistic drop bear in another episode, and we'll just see if somehow it makes its way into you know, Oxford Dictionary Word of the Year or something in 10 years' time. Who knows?
I'll be cheering for you, and I'll help.
Well, Howie, thank you so much for joining us on Language Chats. It's been so great to hear about your work and some of the wonderful stuff that you do. I feel like we could talk for much, much, much longer, but we have already taken up so much of your time. So thank you for joining us here.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and I love what you do on the podcast. So keep fighting the good fight.
We will. And if people want to find out more about what you do, more about your academic work, perhaps some of the articles that you have written, again, we will try and include as much as we can of what has been referenced in this chat in the show notes. But where can they find you online?
Look, I write quite a bit about Australian English on The Conversation. So if you go to The Conversation and just look myself and also my colleague Kate Burridge up there, we write quite a bit about language and Australia, and we write in terms of writing them, we're a lot of fun writing articles about Australian slang, so I hope people enjoy them.
Okay, great. Do you also write sometimes in Indonesian or in any of the other languages that you speak?
I do. I sometimes do things in Indonesian. So you can occasionally find something on the Indonesian Conversation that I've done. So yeah, you can look up there. Kalau orang yang bisa bahasa Indonesia terus bisa ke sana. Yeah, if you speak Indonesian, you could look for them there.
Excellent. Okay, well, we will make sure that all of this information is easy and on hand for anybody who is listening. So do check out the show notes for this episode. But otherwise, thank you for listening to another episode of Language Chats. If you would like to join our community online, we have a Facebook group. It's called Language Lovers AU Community. And you can find other like-minded Australian language lovers located in Australia or abroad there to chat with and to find out other information. We like to share things that are going on in Australia that may be of interest to those who love language. Otherwise, you can find more about this podcast at our website, languagelovers.com.au. We're also in the usual social media places too, on Facebook and on Instagram at languagelovers.au. Howie, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to hearing more about the work that you're doing.
My pleasure.
Okay, thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you next time.